the 2012 election prerequisite edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, we look at the record of the Harper government and list the sins and failures that is the conservative record in the lead-up to the 2012 election. Let's begin episode 282.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week's wine is essentially a setup for this week's show. It has been announced that Dying with Dignity will be losing its charitable status as of mid-February. This has been the hardest hit group, but not the only one. Alternatives, a charity that helps provide funding in developing nations to help local groups improve their community, well, Alternatives was told that it was not paternalistic, one might even say colonial, enough in its undertaking, and had better make more sort of dictatorial control over its projects or they would lose their status. What does that mean? Well, Alternatives raise money. Then, instead of telling the people in third world countries what they should be doing, they find local groups that are striving to come up with homegrown solutions to community problems and enabling them to do it in their own way. The only oversight, the only control Alternative holds, is that of the purse. It said that even if the CRA offered to continue its charitable status, provided the charity take control over their funded projects, they would refuse because that goes against the group's fundamental philosophy. The group funds endeavors like urban agriculture in places like Haiti, labor rights education in Central America, and supports an alternative internet portal for Congo civil society. Another group attacked by CRA is Ecology Action. The CRA advised it that it needed to track its political activities better or else its charitable status would be revoked. Ecology Action has stated that since the warning, they are essentially self-censoring themselves. When in the past they might make a comment, now they call their lawyer first. Or simpler and less expensive, they just keep quiet. One might ask, why so many charities? I've only listed a few. There are over 50 charities that have been subject to special investigation. And when I say special investigation, I don't mean some task group has uncovered wrongdoing and recommended this special task force perform these audits. No. This particular task force was assembled after the Harper government allocated an extra $13.4 million to the CRA, that's Canada Revenue Agency, think of it as the Canuck version of the Yanks IRS, directed specifically at political activities of charities. Although denied by the CRA, it seems that this is a conservative-funded witch hunt to its political adversaries. It has been widely reported that the only criteria one needs to be audited is to take a position contrary to the Harper government, especially if it crosses his fossil fuel agenda. Of course, promoting social justice, like Alternatives was doing, advocating ideology contrary to Harper, like Dying with Dignity, even attempting to prevent poverty seems to be in the crosshairs of this conservative government's witch hunt. That last one was exemplified when the CRA stated Oxfam Canada was not providing a social good because it stated in its submissions for recertification that its mandate was, and I quote, to prevent and relieve poverty, vulnerability, and suffering by improving the conditions of individuals whose lives, livelihood, and security or well-being are at risk. Apparently the line, preventing poverty, struck them as communist or something. According to the head of Oxfam, this discussion between them and the CRA went something like, relieving poverty is charitable, but preventing it is not. Preventing poverty could mean providing for a class of beneficiaries who are not poor. The best analogy I could find is if you think of a soup kitchen. Because anyone can use it, it, strictly speaking, is not helping only the poor. A millionaire could go in there and eat. How is that helping the poor? That means, according to CRA, soup kitchens are just poorly managed restaurants. Their vision, or their worry it seems, is that Oxfam will actually become a group of billionaires trying to ensure that they are billionaires, irrespective of the facts on the ground. Oxfam caved to this linguistic pressure, and so now they are alleviating poverty. Oh yes, about the conservative conspiracy theory with regards to these audits and the hard line of CRA, it is curious that just a few months prior to the CRA ruling, the then employment minister, Jason Kenney, singled out Oxfam over the group's opposition to Israel's settlements in the West Bank. This same Kenney has also been on record for punishing nonprofits for political purposes. KROS, the Canadian Ecumenical Justice Initiative, Canada's faith-based ecumenical organization affecting social change through advocacy, education, research programs in such things as Indigenous rights, ecological economy, women of courage, resources and rights, and watershed disciplineship. Well, in 2009, while speaking in Jerusalem, he said, again, I quote, "We have defunded organizations, most recently like KROS, who have taken a leadership role in the boycott of Israel. We received a lot of criticism for this decision, but we believe we have done the right thing for the right reasons, and we stand by this decision." Right decision perhaps for Israel, but I don't quite see how it was the right decision for Canada. There's another trend I noted in at least two of these cases involving the groups mentioned. Both in the case of Dying with Dignity and Alternatives, the CRA stated that, and again, I paraphrase, the executive director, Michael Lambert of Alternatives, he said that CRA said that they made an error in 1994 by conferring charitable status. They said that they made a mistake 20 years ago when they gave it to us. And in the case of Dying with Dignity, the CRA said the government officials made mistakes in 1982 and 2011 when they formally confirmed and conferred charity status. It occurs to me to be suspicious that, quote, errors were made in the past seems to be a common thread, as though in the past they were judged on merit and now they're judged by some other yardstick. Perhaps, I don't know, one that's conservative blue? Of course, there's another major way these audits are seriously affecting these charities, irrespective of whether or not they lose their status. The harm comes in sort of three major ways. First, these audits are stressful and create a negative work environment. These are often groups held together by hope and a shoestring. The added tension and worry can drastically reduce the effectiveness of these charities. It may turn off potential donors and volunteers. And although I think this is an important aspect, I would, to be honest, have little sympathy if this were a corporation being audited, perish the thought. So moving on. Another aspect in which these unnecessary audits have a deleterious effect on these groups is the time required, the collection of requested documents, the writing of reports, the generation of required paperwork. All that takes time away from the charity's true purpose, time that should, for example, be spent educating people in the environmental damage that tar sands tailing ponds are doing. Now it is wasted rewriting a mission statement to change the word like prevent to mitigate. And of course, another way these CRA shakedowns affect charities is financially. They need to hire lawyers and accountants, pay for printing. They may need to hire extra staff to raid the archives for documentation. The cost of preparing these audits, the legal fees to appeal any decision, or implementing some petty criteria can cause some charities to shut down due to lack of funds. All of these challenges have an effect that even if the CRA can't trip a charity up on some technical failing, they can still negatively impact the charity's ability to do its job. Now, you may be inclined to think that this is just coincidence. It may be that the head of the CRA just hates social justice groups. Or, of course, there may be communications between the PMO's office and the CRA. Of course, we could investigate this. We have in Canada a rapidly aging and growingly ineffective Freedom of Information Act. We could ask to see all the correspondence related to these special audits. And let's not forget, this was a specially funded project by Harper himself. As a conservative senator said, there's a need to investigate into these, quote, involvement of foreign foundations in Canada's domestic affairs and their abuse of existing Revenue Canada's charitable status. And then a former Minister of Environment said we need to worry about environmentalists and other radical groups who threaten to hijack our regulatory system to achieve their radical ideological agenda. A lot of radicals in there. But alas, If we did make a request to find a smoking gun, we would discover that in August of last year, the CIA deleted all its text messages and no longer collects this form of communications. One is left wondering if the PMO or other powers that be were tech-savvy enough to know not to say anything in an email, because of course that's been in the news a lot, because they know that these are archived, but didn't realize that text messages were also stored, or at least were until perhaps someone discovered that there were demands to crack down on, what was it the Public Safety Minister Vic Tayes called them, essentially eco-terrorists, that his possible demands to crush them with paperwork would be recorded in text messages as opposed to emails, well, that kind of discovery could lead one to rapidly try to delete said record. I'm sure they say for administrative purposes, of course, and not political ones, but one is left wondering. I am speculating. But among political pundits, the laser-like focus on groups critical of Harper's regime and the lack of oversight given to pro-Harperite charities is very damning evidence of, if not wrongdoing, then, well, it stinks, really. Anyhow, this is our setup. We'll return after this break.
Science is the best tool ever devised for understanding.
To subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreeThinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreeThinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
In 2004, Frank Warren handed out 3,000 self-addressed postcards to strangers, prompting them to share their secrets. These postcards were collected on his blog, and now Post Secret has become a collaborative movement for millions of unheard voices. This January, Vancouver artists TJ Daw, Khalil Ashanti, and Justin Suds will help bring Post Secret to life as a visual auditory journey through the emotions of our inner life. With music from Mario Vira and multimedia projection, Post Secret makes its Canadian premiere from January 20th to February 7th at the Firehall Centre in downtown Vancouver. For pricing, showtimes, and more information about Post Secret, the show, please visit firehallartcentre.ca.
And we're back. I will be presenting what I hope to be a series of segments I'm calling 2015 Election Prerequisites. As a number of you no doubt are aware, this year could be one of the most important years in Canadian history, because this is an election year. Now some of you may think, oh yes, elections are kind of important, but really? After all, it's Canadian politics. How exciting can it get? Well, I would recast that and say, how dangerous can it get? Now I'll start with a caveat that I may be Chicken Little who mistook an acorn for the falling sky. But I suspect and fear that if I am wrong, I will be more the boy who cried wolf. What's the difference between the two, you might ask? Well, most people tend to forget that in the wolf story, there really was a wolf that eventually did kill everything. And this will be the first federal election since Harper formed the majority government, the first to be held after Harper rammed through his hidden agenda. Agenda that post-majority has been rubbed in our collective faces. It will be the first election after the Unfair Election Acts. Harper has done more damage to Canada, its reputation, and the future of democracy in the last few years than any other force in Canadian history. Now you might say, Don, come on, what are you talking about? He hasn't been that bad, has he? Well, today's show will be an incomplete, I only have an hour show, rundown of the many things the Harper government has done and that we need to remember when it comes to this time voting in the fall. And I am assuming there will be a fall election. One thing, and I confess I'm a bit neutral on this one, but one thing Harper has done was pass a law stipulating when the elections are to be held. Kind of like in the US, everyone knows every 4 years on the first Tuesday of November there will be a presidential election. By setting a hard date, or so the logic goes, it prevents governments from springing an election when there's a chance of winning, when their chances of winning are best, or delaying ones when things are not going so well. So now our elections are fixed for October in the fourth year of the mandate. In Harper's case, that would make it October 19th this year. Of course, even though Harper himself passed this legislation, he has disregarded it, if not in the letter of the law, at least in its spirits, when he dissolved the government in 2008, when there was a risk the opposition would try and replace him with a alternative government. Regardless, this year I am running under the assumption that this October there will be a federal election, and as such, it is, I fear, the last chance to free our nation from this autocratic, authoritarian, and corrupt, I think is a better word, to free our nation from the tyranny that is the Harper Conservative government. Again, you may be saying, what the hell are you talking about, Don? What has he done that has made you so upset as opposed to all the other leaders who are just as vile as our current leader? There are at least 42 major reasons we must dethrone Harper, but before I get into my many, many, many criticisms of Harper, let's first take a moment and listen to the Prairie correspondent on her take on Harper and our veterans.
And it's a crying shame how we get so trained. We can't see past our sad stories and wonder what we're missing. We can't see past our sad stories and forget how to listen. We can't see past our sad stories and wonder what we're doing. Can't see past our sad stories and forget who it is we're fooling.
I've heard in the news that the Harper Conservatives are now hiring for new positions in the Veterans Affairs Service Department. These are not, in the true sense of the word, new positions. They are reincarnations of positions termed when the Veterans Affairs Department closed the offices in 2014. Now, apparently, they're attempting to fill in the holes created by this move. This was when they decided they could save money on the backs of the vets. With little thought given to the hardships caused, the desperate lives, the bodies and minds broken, and not just of the veterans, but their families as well. Who can forget that plaintive cry by one soldier's wife pleading with Fantino as he scurried down the hallway?
Mr. Fantino! I'm just a vet spouse! You're forgetting us! Once more! We're nothing to you! We're the French people at the Legion! But we're just what? Nothing? Nothing! This is what we are! Nothing! Again!
I shudder every time I hear that. It can't be overstated. Harper's greatest goal is to balance the budget. Don't misunderstand me. This is an important undertaking. But at what cost? Do you recall that $1.1 billion Veterans Affairs returned unspent to the conservative federal treasury coffers? And that pledge of $200 million to support mental health initiatives for vets? This was misrepresented to be spent in its entirety over the next 6 years. In reality, it was the funding for the next 50. Well, anyway, despite all the protestations by the vets, the Harper government steamrolled ahead, closed the offices, supposedly replacing them with Services Canada personnel, the people who take care of issues as unemployment insurance, pensions, and passports. Not that these people wouldn't try their best to provide service, but this is hardly the milieu for sufferers of PTSD and other injuries. It's been stated the forms required are lengthy and complicated. This specialized type of service requires a dedicated workforce, familiar with the forms, the protocol, and the veteran's plight, as well as capable of being in it for the long haul. As I understand it, this process takes months, even years, to resolve. There is a specialized service office available in our region, but that office is located about half an hour away down the highway. Not easily accessible by those in need, either logistically or financially. The cons failed to anticipate the backlash that followed the move. For a government that professes to honor our vets, they sure have a strange way of showing it. I may be somewhat jaded here, but could this new initiative have something to do with the approaching federal election? Could they be trying to make up for the extremely disruptive Minister of Veterans Affairs? Please say it isn't so. This excuse for a Democratic government that is the Harper ideological machine is attempting to pull the wool over our eyes, appearing to listen to the complaints of thousands of Canadians. Just how dense do the cons think we are? It's like kicking a dog if he gets in your way. Now that's a bad thing, no argument there. But when you want your dog to be your best friend, well, you throw him a bone. And, of course, Fido's expected to forgive and forget. And for the most part, he will. Because the former abuse, he'll be desperate for attention. And he wants to please. Okay, so that works for animals. But are we really that gullible? No, Herr Harper, not by half. I, for one, don't think we're one bit as gullible as the Harper cons would think us. Remember when, and I'm taking a trip down memory lane here, because it is just memory, everything Harper said in that past pre-majority government speech? It's failed to materialize. Remember the election night speech? He talked about values, democracy, principles, and freedoms, and wow, just look at us today. How far we've fallen. Harper's attacked every single one of those strengths and left them in tatters. He praised the veterans, our current armed forces, and talked of representing all citizens, not only those who voted for him. Well, Steve, I didn't vote for you, and I don't see where you're representing me. I don't see where you're representing the veterans either, for that matter. And you know, I suspect a lot of people that did vote for you are wondering what you're doing. As far as moving forward together, it feels more like being run over by a bus. I think I know how Sona feels.
At all, Canadians made this critically important decision today, friends. They chose hope, unity of purpose, and a strong Canada. And because Canadians chose hope, we can now begin to come together again, as we must, as Canadians, as fellow citizens, friends, and neighbors. For our part, we are intensely aware that we are and we must be the government of all Canadians, including those who did not vote for us.
Rings kind of hollow now, doesn't it? Hard to believe the guy in the big chair in the PMO is the same one who made that acceptance speech, isn't it? So, as it usually turns out, Harper defends his ministers until he thinks he'll be hurt politically by doing so. And this time, it's no different. Harper has had a change of tactic. I was going to say heart, but we know that's not the right word to use when referring to our current PM. Anyway, he removed Fatino from the Veterans Affairs Department. He wasn't fired. He was demoted, shall we say. He now occupies the associate in the Defense Department, a junior position. But he's still in the government. Yes, it's true. Fantino, despite his extraordinary mishandling the Veterans Affairs, Harper, in his great wisdom, did not see fit to banish the man from the Parliament buildings. Why? Well, because Fantino is simply doing the PM's bidding. Fantino's doing as his master dictated. Well, Harper had little choice. The ministers all are simply doing the PM's bidding. Kind of hard to get rid of a person when they're so obediently doing as they're told. But there is another reason for keeping Fantino on the payroll, which has come as no surprise to me, and I'm sure it's no surprise to many others. It is that despite his mishandling of the veterans' portfolio, Fantino is still quite popular in his riding of Vaughan. Now, Harper needs all the help he can get, and Fantino's only too eager to deliver. He's held in high regard, partly as his authoritarian ex-police chief, and also for his tough-on-crime stance, by the Harper conservative voter base. To his supporters, this demotion will appear to be an astute political move by the PM. He has to be seen to do something, and this is as little something as he can manage and still appease the electorate at large. Harper plays the election game far better than he sings. Oh, fair is foul, and foul is fair, to quote Macbeth. Fantino's replacement will be Aaron O'Toole, previously an officer in the Canadian Forces and founder of the True Patriot Love Foundation for programs supporting members of the military, veterans, and their families, and apparently held in higher regard by the veterans than his predecessor, Julian Fantino. Until his new appointment, he was Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of International Trade. While the honeymoon period should be brief, as O'Toole is familiar with the issues, having been called upon to assist Fantino when things began to go south. So if Harper's expecting some respite from disgruntled vet, he's wrong. Harper has forgotten, it seems, that these men have been in battles that required stamina and tactical strategy, and they're not going to be distracted with the bait-and-switch game. O'Toole has a steep climb ahead of him if he has any hope of rebuilding the fences that have been torn down, and I have little confidence that this new renewed vigor to support our vets will last long after the next election, if we are of such ill fortune to see the cons back in power. And I'd be remiss here if I didn't point to the fact that O'Toole is a Harper man. In my mind, that says it all. His being a minister in the Harper Conservatives bears witness to the fact he holds the same beliefs as his boss, and as those before him and those beside him, he'll do as he's told. The Canadian Legions called it a political move, others a restorative measure for the Harper Conservative constituency. As I mentioned earlier, there's an election coming and all the telltale signs are evident. Keep tuned for more Harper tricks of the trade as he realizes his reign of abuse may be at an end and he attempts to show himself as a caring leader for all Canadians. Card he's played before, with success, I must add. Well, there is hope, and I see it rising right here on the prairies, the conservative heartland of Canada. In the disheartenment that's been prevalent under the current government, once again, our veterans are coming to our rescue, attempting to pull us through this quagmire created by the mismanagement of our democracy by the Harper Conservatives. A group of angry veterans who want the Harper government defeated in the next election is appealing to the serving members of the military to join them in protest. There's a young soldier here in our area, a decorated veteran of the Afghanistan War. He's put his name forward to run under the Liberal banner in the upcoming election. And he's been a very able spokesman for the vets, articulately standing up for his and their rights, very well prepared and knowledgeable, having himself had to run the gauntlet with this federal government. He's now taken up the challenge for the citizens in the next election. This appears to be a formidable challenge, and now the feds are worried. They brought out the heavy guns, and that failed abysmally. So now they're trying the I feel for you man tactic. Well, that line worked for Robin Williams, because he was believable. We liked him, and he was a good guy. You, Mr. Harper, are none of the above.
And it's a crying shame how we get so trained. We can't see past our own sad stories and wonder why we're missing. We can't see past our own sad stories and forget how to listen. We can't see past our own sad stories and wonder what we're doing. Can't see past our own sad stories and forget who it is we're fooling.
Well put. I'll give you a moment to go grab a coffee. If you get a pen and paper, does anyone even use pen and paper anymore? Okay, so go grab your tablet and get ready to take some notes. When we return, 42 reasons to ensure Harper is not re-elected in 2015 and thus save Canada as both a free and democratic society.
Another night's work well done. And so easy without that nuisance Spider-Man.
I didn't know you cared.
You!
Yes, Electro, and I'm going to short-circuit you once and for all.
You would have been better off in the hands of the police. You are no match for my power.
It takes more than power to win. It takes brains and knowing your enemy.
I'll pick my power against your brains any day. What was that?
That, my thieving fiend, is the result of brains.
Use your brain. Turn off all the lights when you leave a room. If every household in BC turned off one light bulb for 4 hours a day for 1 year, it would save enough electricity to power all the homes in Mission for an entire year. This Power Smart play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts on Commercial Drive and other areas at
Bone Rattle Music Limited, High Life Records, People's Co-op Bookstore, Audio Pile Records, Bad Bird Media, Band Merch Canada, Vancouver Music Gallery, and Pandora's Box Rehearsal Studios.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
And we're back. It's 2012 Election Prerequisite, Episode 1. So there are so many things I have to say. I am unsure where to start. I thought I would begin by attacking a premise that has been repeatedly debunked, that I am still gobsmacked people believe is true. The fallacy that conservatives are the best economic managers. Ha! Let's start with how wisely they managed the government's coffer when it had been used to replace our aging military equipment. The government is now committed to approximately $33 billion in the procurement of 15 surface combat ships, 8 non-combat craft, and 5 to 6 Arctic patrol ships. I'm going to focus on those last patrol ships. Well, originally, there were to be 8, but the money that the Conservative government had put aside for the project fell short. Seems like they couldn't do their calculations quite well. It was also reported that the Irving Shipping was paid over $250 million to design the Arctic ships. But one must ask, how good of an investment was that? First is the fact that Canada actually purchased a Norwegian design for the ships for $5 million. Why are we paying 25 to 50 times more to have Irving just sort of tweak the design? In fact, the total cost for those Norwegian ships were about $100 million each. The Danish are building two similar ships for about $100 million, and the Irish have a project for two for about $125 million each. So one must have to wonder why our ships are expected to cost $700 million each. That is anywhere from 7 to 14 times the cost of other nations. The Harper Conservatives good with money? Well, they seem to be getting hosed on these ships. Oh yes, and then there was the F-35s, which we were told would cost about $141 million, but as the Parliamentary Budget Officer revealed, would have a true cost of $41 billion for the 65 planes. On order. In fact, as a true cost of this albatross became known, more and more nations were canceling their orders. It was also made evident that these jets were selected not through an open competition bid, but as an edict from on high, likely some under-the-table handshake between the U.S. and Canada military. It was pointed out, when this financial deceit came to light, that Boeing had the Super Hornet, which was not only better suited for the Canadian Air Force, but would cost half as much as well. Note my emphasis on Canadian. One of the quote pluses of the F-35 was how easily it would integrate into the American military operations. So since when did we buy an aerial force with the intent of letting the Yanks use it? Another item in Harper's agenda was to dramatically drop Canada's peacekeeper image for that of a more aggressive military power. and has taken every opportunity to offer our planes and other military assets to any U.S. military operation. It seems Harper doesn't care what the price for his military aggrandizement costs you or me as the taxpayer, not to mention the integrity of Canadians on the world stage. Another example of Harper government's waste is the ill-spent millions in taxpayer money on advertisements. First, some of the advertisements come dangerously close to Conservative Party partisan ads. Let us not forget the large government checks used for numerous funding announcements that displayed Conservative Party blue banding and a maple leaf logo prominently on it. All the while, it was actually taxpayer money, but it looked like it was a Conservative donation. And then there were the advertising campaigns for projects that never were. They spent $2.5 million on a jobs grant program that never existed. The Harper government spent another $14-plus million on Canada's Economic Action Plan 2 years after the program had ended. Then there was the Temporary Foreign Workers Program that allowed employers in key hard-to-staff industries to essentially import temporary workers. These are jobs where there are no Canadians able to do the work, or that was the purpose for which the program was intended and how it had operated for most of its life. But once the Harper government took over, they gamed the system by such tactics as reducing the investigation time from 6 months to 6 weeks for the labor market impact assessment, so that now it is possible for Tim Hortons, McDonald's, and others to claim they need to import workers. This has had two ill effects. It allowed employers to abuse their temporary workers who feared being sent back home, and it, of course, it suppresses wages. You see, if you can't get someone to work that shitty graveyard shift at McD's, you might have, in the past, offered an incentive like more money. But the Harper Conservatives, with governmental lack of oversight, allowed the abuse of vulnerable foreign workers by their exploitative employers, and thus, instead of paying more to get someone to work the night shift, you just imported someone and paid them less. Then there was the Conservative government's war on science. This was accomplished in two ways. First, you had the muzzling of scientists. That is, government scientists were not allowed to talk to the press without prior approval from some political official. It had gotten so bad that at one conference of scientists, each scientist was accompanied by a political officer to ensure that they didn't stray off script. This reminds me of the bad old days where Soviet scientists were chaperoned by KGB agents. The practice has gotten a lot of international attention, resulting in several letters signed by preeminent scientists around the world protesting the conditions their Canadian brethren are facing and are forced to work under. I mean, that makes it sound like some third world dictatorship. Oh yes, Harper. Just to give an example, one Canadian journalist was trying to get a quote for a report about snowfall research done jointly with Canada and NASA officials in Ontario. It took days for the request to be approved after being reviewed by dozens of political officials, way too late to be used by the reporter, who, as a backup, called the NASA scientist and conducted his interview with them right then and there. No political master approval needed. I said this is one way the government has been waging a war on science. The other is the drastic cuts to funding. The politicalization of our science was best exemplified when the minister in charge of science funding stated that such grants were going to be shifted away from pure science, the kind that makes landmark discoveries, to application research, essentially to bring products to market, essentially turning Canadian scientists into engineers for major corporations. And of course, we cannot forget that in the so-called effort to promote academic research, the Harper government closed 7 of 8 Department of Fishery and Oceans research libraries across the country. And this was just not a consolidation. No, books were burnt. People could walk in off the street and walk out with irreplaceable tomes. This, of course, on the heels of an omnibus budget bill that stripped fisheries and oceans' responsibility to ensure millions of Canadians' waterways were protected. 99% of Canada's 2.5 million lakes and rivers are now unprotected. And it's not just those pesky scientists that keep repeating that our country's pro-oil practices, pro-fish farm, our generally pro-corporatist policies may not be in the best interest for the country. It seems simply keeping records has become another enemy of the Harper regime. He who controls the present controls the past. He who controls the past controls the future, a la 1984. In a move to prevent proper accountability, Harper also oversaw the gutting of Library and Archives of Canada, a 20% reduction in staffing, a reduction of spending to the point of endangering major projects intended to help Canadians access the archives of this nation. They reduced hours, limited access, and made things like interlibrary loans a thing of the past. What are they trying to hide? This is yet another way the Harper government, who on the one hand despises handouts to people in need, but feels quite comfortable providing welfare to his corporate donors. On that note, I just read where the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, far from a socialist group, published that it was estimated the Harper government provided well over $34 billion a year in subsidies for Canada's fossil fuel industry. And by Canada, I mean the US and Chinese companies that own the majority of our oil and gas industry. And that leads nicely into the major trade deal Harper signed with China, a deal we are locked into for 35 years, unprecedented, which provides Chinese companies the ability to challenge Canadian law, not in a courtroom, but via arbitration, arbitration that is pro-corporation. Thus, if Canada decided to get serious about climate change and we enacted a carbon tax, the Chinese Oil Corp could challenge the law, saying that it would cost them millions of dollars and lost potential profit, and that the Canadian government would either have to pony up the cash or rescind the law. And of course, there is the current Trans-Pacific Partnership deal that is being negotiated by Canada in private for fear that its implications would be so unpopular to the people of this nation, well, we might just actually dethrone Harper. This treaty, from what has been leaked out by groups like WikiLeaks, will have major implications for copyright, the elevation of corporate rights over those of citizens, leading a race to the bottom for things like environmental and labor rights, public welfare. It also allows for the challenging of laws not to a court, but a corporate tribunal, just like the deal with China. And who among us can forget the cute, cuddly pandas? Okay, not the worst thing Harper has done, but it seems they were the price China paid for the one-sided trade agreement, something many previous MPs have tried to get, i.e. the pandas, but perhaps none of them were as willing to betray our national interest as Harper seems to have been. But he did manage to get a couple of pandas who will be our guests at our expense of over $1 million a year for a decade. I'm sure he saw that there were some good votes in that. Well, we should take a break about now. I can feel my face redden with anger, so before I blow a cap, we'll return after this break.
Bob, you're wasting me precious carbon dioxide. I'm pumping it into the atmosphere, boy. Thanks to global warming, the temperature will soon go through the roof, and then we'll have an endless summer.
Why do you want an endless summer, Mr. Krabs?
So I can open me latest money-making venture, the Krusty Pool.
The endless summer does sound fun.
And profitable.
Fun and profitable. Big business does it again.
Unfortunately, for those of us who aren't talking sponges, climate change isn't quite as fun. Luckily, there are many easy ways for students to conserve energy.
If chargers for cell phones, cameras, and laptops are left plugged in, they continue to draw electricity even when not connected to the device. This phantom load can be avoided by unplugging electronics and chargers after use. A more convenient option is to hook electronics up to a power bar, which can be switched off after use.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
And we're back. Okay, besides being a poor economic manager of the nation, Harper also feels the fact that he won a majority, well, a majority of seats, but he accomplished his feat with only 39.6% of the popular vote, which translates to only 20.1% of the actual nation's population. Anyway, with this weak mandate, he now feels that he has the right to push forward any element of his agenda, claiming that is why he was elected. So in this theme, he destroyed the Canadian Wheat Board, a collective monopoly for selling Canadian wheat and barley crops. This in spite of the fact that the vast, vast majority of Canadian farmers wanted to keep the board and felt its collective power gave farmers a better price and security than without the board, something that will, however, be a boon for corporations that support the Conservative Party. So great was Harper's hatred for the board, he was not content to remove its monopoly, but has legislation that forces its liquidation into a private corporation by 2016. Harper removed the long gun registry against the vocal opposition of every law enforcement agency across the nation. And also on that well-worn chopping block, facing death by a thousand hacks of the axe, is the CBC, our national broadcaster. Prior to his majority government, then Minister of Canadian Heritage, James Moore, promised the CBC funding would not be cut. I repeat, not cut. And then the very first budget, after the majority win, CBC funding was cut. So egregious has been the cuts every year, every budget, that the CBC lost its flagship sports program, Hockey Night in Canada. The iconic Canadian sport will no longer be the purview of the nation's broadcaster, but have the CBC reduced to janitorial and rental services for the now rights holders, Rogers. The last round of cutbacks seems to have been the last straw to many, for soon afterwards, a significant number of the talented and experienced staff left the CBC, citing the cuts had created a hostile environment, and that many found the current funding prevented them from producing quality productions. Another valued and integral institution that Harper believes he has a mandate to destroy is Canada Post. In all fairness, with the advent of email, one could say Canada Post is no longer as important for the movement of mail as it once was. Of course, that ignores the fact that although correspondence mail has declined, the increase of shopping online has resulted in a great demand for parcel post delivery. No, Harper just hates the idea of a public institution. The only thing he seems value in, beyond his, quote, musical ability, is private corporations. He'd sell off the air we breathe if he could figure out a way. He is well on his way with the gutting of environmental protections and is pandering to multinational energy corporations. I make this statement because, even those who think Canada Post's role as a mail delivery is irrelevant, well, you should repurpose that infrastructure created by Canada Post. Canada Post could be transformed into the People's Bank, providing basic banking and insurance services to those who can't access or are not monetary valuable enough for traditional banks. We did a whole segment about this. Now, if Harper allowed that precedent to stand, then people might take a second look at the CBC or the Canadian Wheat Board and say, well, even assuming Harper's criticism, we could still use institutions to do X, Y, or Z. Perhaps the CBC could be used as an open university, for instance. They have something like that in the UK. Who knows what could be accomplished with a little non-conservative thinking. Harper knows that creating the infrastructure for any social service is the hardest part, that once it has been destroyed, the likelihood of it being rebuilt is minute. Again, once we lose the CBC, our ability to reconstitute in the future will be highly unlikely. This is why we need to retain our public broadcaster in the form we expect. We just can't let the CBC die due to lack of funding. Some of his actions have already caused permanent and irreparable damage. When he abolished the mandatory long-form census, he basically tossed over a century of historical data into the bin. The census is the way we know what's happening in our nation. It provides stats on Canada's population density, its demographic, economic status, the availability of government services. It's the basic information that city planners, civil servants, and even politicians use to develop policies. Where to allocate resources, to understand what the needs are of society. And why? Well, ostensibly because people complained that it violated their right of privacy, as well as they objected to the mandatory aspect of the long-form census, even though there were no instances I could find of anyone being fined for not completing their census. The real reason, as I see it, is that without an accurate demographic information provided by the long-form census, the ability for the government to know where to spend resources to promote the best social goods is degraded. And why would Harper want to do this? Well, for one, instead of spending money on economically depressed areas who tend not to vote conservative, he can now provide a kickback of sorts to conservative loyal constituencies that vote conservative. There's also the infamous comment from then Minister of Justice Stockwell Day when he said the crime rate in Canada was on the rise, in spite of the fact that StatsCan reported that crime was on the decline. Dave retorted that he believed unreported crime was on the rise, a preposterous claim, but it did provide the political justification to spend millions on the construction of more prisons. Another example of Harper's conservatives' mismanagement of the government's purse. Well, earlier I said unnecessary, but he did have an agenda. although this part of his scheme did not surface until later. He planned to fill those prisons by enacting higher minimum sentences, and due to the change, increased the number of punishable crimes. Another tactic that has proven in many experiments around the world to fail. Even Texas. Yes, Texas. It has changed its tough-on-crime stance by shifting emphasis from financial black holes of mandatory sentences to focus instead on rehabilitation and prevention. Of course, Harper will not follow a plan that works if it means providing a social service for the average Canadian. Well, that's not who he's working for. If there was a way to provide financial support on the government teat, that would be something Harper would push for. Hint, hint, prison contractors. It is not only kickback to his supporters and future employers. Let us not forget, former prime ministers can look forward to making millions as advisors to moneyed interest. Not surprisingly, the same interest for which such PMs were enacting legislation and crafting public policy. I am sure that politicians never allowed the thoughts about their post-parliamentary payday influence them. Ha! Then, of course, there's also the question, where does the money go? Well, it was reported that the Harper government has provided over $35 billion in subsidies for the oil and gas industry. That accounts for about 12% of the current revenue for all of 2014. That, even if we didn't increase public spending on necessary social programs like daycare, you would think that a fiscally conservative would be annoyed that instead of lining the pockets of the fat cats, this could, in and of itself, reduce the public debt by 5% a year. You know, every time Harper and his gang cut spending, they wave the banner proclaiming that we're running a deficit, that the public debt is a bad thing. We need to bring down the debt at all costs. Sorry, vets, healthcare, foreign aid, all things must bend to balance the budget. And yet, on the heels of announcing a balanced budget, that was the one before oil prices dropped, as well as the pants on the conservative economic gurus, there was the promise of tax benefit to those who can afford to send their kids to hockey camp or the like. They're also going to allow something called income splitting, a practice where you have one member of the household who makes too much money. Well, they can transfer a portion to their partner for the purpose of cutting taxes, and therein pay less in income tax. Beyond the fact that Harper is using these taxes as a form of social engineering, it has been estimated that this would cost the public purse $5 billion a year. Note the social engineering part here. First, singles are left out, and those couples who decide not to have kids, well, they're likely to both be working, thus no need for splitting incomes. Now, this is a not-so-subtle carrot to encourage couples to have a proper family where there are 2.1 kids, a stay-at-home mom who takes care of them. He also announced an increase to the universal child care benefit. Of course, the reality of the matter is, in most families, both parents are working already just to make ends meet. And because of the continual wage deflation of the middle class, they just don't make enough money to benefit from income splitting. Now, the real beneficiary of this tax break is the top 5%. In this percentage, the average couple could save anywhere from $1,000 to $5,000, or so it's been reported. Nice pre-election bribe. I mean, promise. I wonder who they're going to support with their political donations. So again, returning to the theme. When it comes to supporting the CBC to maintain funding for the internationally important and over 50-year-old Environmental Lakes Program, for veterans' mental health, revamping the Canada Post. The answer is we need to cut deficit, reduce the deficit, balance the budget. But tax perks to corporations and the rich? Sure, no problem. You see, I think there is a fundamental problem with the conservative mindset. They see outgoings as loss, a bad thing. Stop spending money because it is money we will no longer have. But they don't see unearned money as spent money. They think if they didn't collect taxes on a corporation, that money never existed as government revenue. So it doesn't count. But this is clearly nuts. Tax breaks are spending. It is taking future earned money and not collecting it. Real economists note that there are two sides to a budget, incomings and outgoings. That is, if a budget is to balance, if debts are to be reduced, we not only need to reduce the outgoings, we need to increase the incomings. You and I know that we can reduce the amount we spend. Less takeout, for instance. Make those shoes last another month. Do we really need a smartwatch? There's only so much you can cut before it has a deleterious effect. If we stopped taking the medication the doctor prescribed, skipped a meal or two, hey, I could save a bundle by moving into that cardboard box down by the river. That is not a path a nation should walk, but it is a path to the bottom, and Herr Hitler is leading the way. A rational person would, at a certain point in cutting back, say to themselves, maybe I should increase the amount of money coming in. Maybe work a few more hours. Make some money on YouTube. Join Uber. You might find that not only are you making more money, but you can now pay off your debt. You might even be able to spend a little on luxuries, like sign up for a course at college. This may then allow you to make even more money. This would be anathema to our current government. They adhere to the idea that if you give a lot of food to a few yachts, then all boats will enjoy a bigger meal. I'm unsure how. Maybe the other boats feed off the crumbs left behind? No, the historically proven Nobel Prize-winning economist proved a better model is to provide all ships with a little food, and in that way, all are enriched, and not just a few who become obese. Okay, I know that analogy usually works with water, but I've never quite understood how the rich were going to increase the tide. Maybe it's a pee joke and everyone just sort of missed it. I don't know. But of course, the claim that conservatives are masters of economics is destroyed when you think about the current budget issue. Our keepers of the book, our esteemed Joe Oliver, the Minister of Finance, had to postpone the budget because he had no plan B. They are now scrambling to figure out what to do now that oil is trading at levels not seen for several years. But why the scramble? You might say, because no one predicted that the oil would have dropped to the levels they are today. Well, economists, by and large, are not surprised. No one knew exactly when the drop would occur, but they all knew it was coming. It was not like this was the first time. Commodities have a habit of running in a continual cycle of boom and bust. One of the rationales for the wheat board was to spread out this boom and bust scenario over time so as to lessen the effect on farmers. It provided a counterbalance to the natural swings in the market. The dissolution of the Canadian Wheat Board provides another example of the economic irrationality of Harper. Back to my point. The drop in oil prices was expected, and if the Conservatives were masters of the economy as they portray, and we as a society have been hypnotized into believing, they would have not only had their election budget that they previewed last year, but an alternative budget, a set of budgets, that would have taken into account the possible swings in prices. I feel in my bones they did have a surprise budget that predicted oil at $200 a barrel. It's currently selling for under $50, about the same price as it did in 2009. You see, if the Harper government were true conservatives, and not the radical neocon corporatists that they are, they would have not cut taxes for the rich. They might have reduced the subsidies on big oil. Then, if the price of oil collapsed, as it has, you would have had a $13 billion buffer and not the current $3 billion one, which most pundits seem to agree has probably evaporated thanks to our dependency on basic commodities like oil.